Morning.
Good morning.
Am I coming across okay?
Yeah, how about me?
Yeah. It's been a
It's,
while.
I know.
'Cause I think
It
the last
has.
time I recorded with you was over a month at least.
At
Maybe in
least, yeah.
December.
I was just thinking about that one the last time.
Yeah. 'Cause I think the
Was.
last one I recorded, it was just me and Rob.
And then before that, you
That
did a
was
solo
you
one.
and Rob. Yeah, I did a solo one. That's right. I forgot about that one.
Yeah.
That's because I prepared and things didn't work out, so I just said might as well record. Hey, I just wanted to offer my condolences for Dusty.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, for those who've heard me talk about him on the podcast before, a couple, I guess it's, excuse me, been a few weeks now, maybe 3 weeks. Our cat passed away. But he had cancer pretty bad. We didn't find out about it till basically right before the end. Because it was kind of hard to detect, but he lived a long life, so we're happy about that. And it's always hard to lose a pet. He was definitely part of the family.
Yeah.
My wife had him for 15 years, so it's still an adjustment. You get used to having him around, and so we're still thinking that, you see them and stuff like that, but
Yeah.
starting to adjust and get used to it a little bit.
Yeah, it's rough.
It's always tough.
Yeah. 'Cause they are
But
family
it's.
members and they're always around, you know?
So we just.
How's the dog taking it? 'Cause they used to be together. I mean,
Yeah, they I'm not really sure. She hasn't shown any really obvious signs.
yeah, not even initially.
I mean, the first couple of days she could tell I could tell she could tell we were upset, So she was watching us closely to try to
Yeah.
figure out,
What
what
could
was
I
wrong,
do? Yeah.
what was different, but since then I haven't noticed too much, except for when I'm working, a lot of times he would be on the futon next to me, and she's been hanging out in that spot a lot of times during when I'm working, so it's almost like
She's taking that role.
she's taking on that role. Like she's like,
Yeah.
okay, I gotta step up a notch in the pack. This
Yeah.
is my job now. I don't know, or I could just be reading into it, but
Yeah.
so I know he like when we lost Luna, our dog, and for about 8 months we only had Dusty. I think he enjoyed being the
Only one.
only one.
Yeah.
Not
Could have been the
so.
personality wise too, you know.
Yeah.
Like I think Risa wanted to be more alone, even though she dug Scooter. I think she was the type of dog to like want to have her own thing. She was more of a cat, plus a herding dog. She like had a job. She got used to Scooter. And Scooter just want I think Scooter was more of a social light, you know? Like he as much social stuff he could get. Harley, it's too hard to tell. She doesn't know how to be social. Like I think even when she was in a house full of cats and dogs, she didn't understand her role or couldn't figure it out.
Yeah, it's interesting to see their interactions, their different personalities. I know when Mabel was in her foster home, there were other dogs there, but now she's doesn't really have any social. She hasn't had any socialization since then, really. You know, so she definitely reacts to dog when she hears dogs or sees them walking by the house and stuff. She definitely wants to assert herself.
Yeah. And we lost our vet. Like, he moved to a different location, and that was hard because he had been so much part of all our dogs, you know? So we were thinking of moving, but he just doesn't have hours that we can get to easily with our jobs and stuff, and he's way up there.
Mm.
So we took Harley for her test fairly recently, and she's like, oh, she checks out good, but man, her heart rate is so low. She's like, she barks a lot at the vet. Like, she doesn't want to be there. She doesn't like try to bite anybody or anything, but
mm-hmm.
she doesn't like, if it was more open, but they seal you in like this small room, and she can't stand that. Like, she hates mm-hmm. that. And they checked her heart rate, and they said, man, her heart rate should be higher than 80. It's like, so they did blood work and everything, but everything turned out all right. And I look out for her. Like, I notice when things are different. So I just think she has a low heart rate, but
mm-hmm.
she does exercise quite a bit unless the weather's bad. You know, she gets over a mile walk every day, and she throws her tantrums and stuff. So
mm-hmm.
we were relieved to find out that her blood work and everything came back normal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah, Mabel hates the vet, but she doesn't really bark there. She just gets real anxious and shakes.
Mm-hmm.
Last time we took her for a checkup, which thankfully she hasn't had to go for any other reason since then, but she was, they have the exam table in the rooms, you know, and then, but then they have like a little bench area where the owners sit.
Yeah.
And until it was time for the exam, she was
on the bench,
on the bench next to me. And then when the doctor came in the room, she was sitting really still and trying to hide behind me.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't think that's going to work. They know you're there.
Yeah. Harley's really vocal, but I think you experienced it. Like, when you first came into the house, you know, she's just really loud. She just does that. She's like, hey, I'm here. What are you doing here?
Yeah.
But like the old veterinarian, Dr. Bush, he already knew her like inside and out, and he wouldn't have to try to muzzle her or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But this veterinarian wants to. I think she gets scared. So and it's like she's not snapping to bite. She's snapping because she doesn't want to be there. And then she's vocal as it is.
Mm-hmm.
But how's everything been? Did you have an okay holiday except for the losing Dusty?
Yeah, it was fine. I mean, the older I get, the more the holidays can seem like a hassle sometimes. I mean, it's nice to see everybody, you know, but we had to sort of, for a few years now, we had everything kind of figured out as far as our two families go.
Mm-hmm.
We had everything kind of, well, it just kind of worked out. We were doing my family on Christmas Eve, and then my wife's on Christmas Day, but then this year things kind of got, we weren't able to do Christmas Eve at my family's this year, so we kind of had to do both the same day, but it took a while just like arranging that and figuring it out and just coordinate everything. I mean, it's really not a big deal, but it was just kind of had to change things up a little this year. And It's not. I like seeing everybody, and I like, but the whole presence thing, I'm totally over. Like,
yeah,
I could do without all that.
I agree. I wish we would just buy gifts for the kids. Like,
yeah,
that's it. You know, like, cause I don't know. Me and Barbara at a point now where it's like, if we need anything, we buy it. Like, we don't even ask each other. We just buy it. And so every day is a gift, I guess you could say. But we always get gifts, and it's like, you know, I don't know. I wish the gift part would go away. Or we'd adapt something like draw out of a hat and pick one gift for one person, you know, like I would rather it go to that, but the gift thing could go away. But I do wish I could spend more time. Like, I don't know. It just seems different. I mean, your parents and stuff are relatively close, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like mine are not, I mean, yeah, 6 hours away, but And family is everybody seems to be getting older, and it's like, God dang, I wish I could just, you know, spend more time, because everybody's getting older, and every time you see them every year, it gets more noticeable, you know, because you don't see them as much. I guess if you see them daily, it's like you're both aging together, but when you don't see them as much, it's different.
Yeah, you know, you notice it more when we don't see someone every day. I mean, I'm grateful that three of my grandparents are still alive. Mm-hmm. You know, but they are, of course, all in their middle and late 80s now. So that's become you know, and I don't see them as much as I probably should, so that was it was very noticeable with all three of them this past Christmas that they you know, and they've all been through a lot health wise in recent years, as you kind of, it's kind of natural for their age, you know.
Yeah.
And you could see it's taken its toll and stuff on them. So yeah, you notice it.
I'm kind of ready to retire. I really am. I'll probably go back to work on my own terms at some point, because I imagine that for somebody that's worked his entire life since he's 15, I think I will get bored, or I'll need to, but like it would be on my terms, which means I can work 20 hours a week or whatever, you know what I mean? Like,
right,
do whatever I want on my terms, and then just enjoy getting things done that I've always wanted to do. But man, I'm sort of counting the months, man.
Have you had a plan in place for that, or is it just starting? Are you just starting to think about it?
No, I've been thinking about it. I'm pretty much a little over four years away.
Yeah.
And if everything goes according to plan, and Trump doesn't get rid of things, and do something stupid with Social Security, then I think everything's gonna line up properly.
Yeah. Well, if he puts the border up along Colorado, that might make some difficulties. But
yeah, I just don't remember what side of the wall we're on.
Well, it's hard when he doesn't know either.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
Yeah, he doesn't even know where the Chiefs are from.
Right. Yeah, geography is not a strong suit.
Yeah.
But to say the least. But yeah, well, that's... I guess mid-50s is when it's kind of like this earliest bracket.
It's way too early for a normal person usually. But
well,
somebody that doesn't have kids, and somebody that's sort of been preparing for it, it's
Right.
feasible, you know?
Yeah, usually, I mean, it's not unheard of. It's possible. It's not as common as usually, like around mid-60s, is where more people are
Usually
into.
people do wait till 60 at the earliest, and
Yeah.
then, you know,
Early 60s, and
yeah.
well, unfortunately, a lot of people aren't even able to retire then,
Yeah, that's true.
So if you're able to, it's
Some
definitely
people
something to
don't want
be.
to retire,
Some
and
people don't want to.
that's their prerogative.
Like my father-in-law, who only finally retired because the longer he worked, the less money he'd be making in retirement.
Yeah.
And then he just turned around and got consulting jobs.
Was that at 65, or did he
Even
stay
older, yeah. I mean,
older?
yeah. He's in his 70s now, and it was only a few years ago, so.
Yeah, there is that point of diminishing returns, but I think in his case, if he wanted to stay working, it's worth it. Like if that's what makes you happy or feel worth, then that's what you should do. I mean, as long as you can, right? As long as you physically can.
Yeah, I think going with some like finding some consulting work was a good solution for him, you know, because he didn't have to worry about, you know, losing money on his pension or whatever. I don't know the exact details. I just know that he'd gotten to the point where the longer he worked, the less he was going to be making. So, yeah. But yeah, so yeah, you're definitely right that there's
I things
people that
could
don't want to
change and I
retire.
might stay, but I can't do what I'm doing at this level of stress in at 55. Like I just can't. I'd have to do something else. It's just too much anxiety and stress and lack of sleep. I even tried to get on melatonin to sleep better. Because that's like a natural thing your body produces, and I thought taking that,
Yeah.
but that didn't help. That like sort of helped me like knock out, but I can't explain what it like made me dream about, like more vivid dreams and stuff, and it I didn't like it.
Yeah.
So it's like I just do the natural thing and get up at 3 a.m. and read comics. Which is what I did this morning, too.
Yeah. Yeah, that can be a good route to go. I know my mother, before she retired, she stepped down from from a management position and just kind of did what the people she had been managing did, you know,
Yeah.
just like you know, come into work, do her job, not have to worry as much about other people.
Yeah.
I know that she didn't do that for real long, but it did make a big difference in her stress levels and stuff.
Sure.
So that can be a good option sometimes.
So what have you been reading?
Well, not a lot, but I did read some stuff for today.
So
I've
what
been
have you done on your leisure time? If you're not reading, are you watching things? Are you
Yeah, a mixture. When
gaming?
I will talk probably a little bit about this today, but I've continued my like 90s science fiction television watching project.
Ah.
So I do that occasionally, especially if I have like something like folding laundry or just something like that to do with my hands. It's nice to be able to have something to put on and not have to think about it too much, like what do I want to watch. But so I've been doing that, and then I was gonna tell you, you'd be happy to hear that I have been doing something that's very physical media. I haven't really been playing video games because my day job, you know, is very keyboard and mouse intensive.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just pounding the keys all day long, pretty much. And then it started at first. I noticed, like, if I was doing stuff on the computer at home in the evening, it would bother me because obviously that's the same exact kind of motions. And then
like a carpotunnel type things and.
Yeah, or just I don't know if it was specifically carpal tunnel, but they call it like RSI, repetitive stress.
Yeah.
Constant
mouse movement and.
Yeah, like people also people that like work in trades, like that work with their hands, like carpenters and stuff like that, can run into it too. Or just the muscles in my neck getting really stiff and sore, and I'd wake up with it in kind of in pain.
And I
noticed that, and it wasn't so bad using a controller, but then it started to get where the using the controller was irritating me as well. So I really kind of tapered off playing video games, but I miss that kind of mental interaction. Like, for I know for some people, like, and I have my moments like this too, but they, like, a game of some sort can be a bit too much as a relaxation. But for me, a lot of times, if I can, if it captures all of my attention, it kind of, it replaces the noise in my brain.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Like, it's helpful for anxiety and stuff, because if a game is really engaging for me and I really have to concentrate on a lot of different moving pieces, so to speak, that it'll kind of occupy my entire brain, and I'll sort of, and it is relaxing because it quiets the noise. So I kind of missed that, and I discovered that solo board gaming has become a lot more of a thing.
Oh, interesting.
especially, you know,
because solo board, like, do you mean playing with yourself, or do you mean like playing with a group of people?
I mean playing by yourself.
You can play a board game like that?
Yeah, it's so I had been aware, you know, that there's a big market of just being like involved in geeky hobbies and stuff, that there's a lot of board games out there, and a lot of very involved board games, not just your Monopoly and Scrabble and that kind of thing.
Risk
and, I mean, Scrabble and Risk, you are sort of starting to move a little bit more intense than just your like Monopoly or something simple like that. But and I also knew that there were cooperative games where you're not competing against each other, that you're working together towards a goal. And I know a lot of games that come out of Europe, and I had played a couple over the years, like Settlers of Catan has become pretty well known, and Ticket to Ride. Like, you can find these more well-known popular ones at Target and stuff nowadays. But yeah, a lot of those more like geeky, specialized store sort of games. There's a lot more that have solo variants, or might even be specifically designed for a single player. And it's kind of like, it's weird because you don't think of playing board games by yourself, but we all are aware of like solitaire, like playing solitaire.
Yeah, that's the only game I think I've ever played by myself, or if it's like some kind of phone game.
Right. Yeah. Right. And yeah, and that
outside of a video game.
Right, and well, and phone games, I mean,
like,
are
even Monopoly,
video games.
Like, if you play it on the computer, you could play by yourself.
Right.
Or with the internet, and it's like you're playing with yourself. Well, I shouldn't have said it that way, but
So yeah, I've been really into playing with myself lately. That's how I pass the
yeah.
time.
That's right.
But no, I mean, I am interested I would like playing with other people as well.
Well, have you got? Let me ask one other question since we're on the gaming. Have you guys pursued that Dungeons and Dragons thing yet, or is it still in the back burner?
It's still in the works. We actually were scheduled to play the day that we took Dusty in.
Ah.
So we're tentatively maybe going to try again this upcoming weekend. So yeah, that relates pretty closely to, board gaming and tabletop gaming kind of encompasses that, and like games like Dungeons and Dragons and stuff. But yeah, I mean, if you think about it though, we don't think it's strange to play a video game by yourself. Like, people do that all the time. It's really normal. And honestly, it scratches the same itch for me mentally, and it is really similar. It's just you're using physical components instead. Like I said, some are designed for the out on the outset that a lot of them are games that also might be played cooperatively, so it's really easy to adjust to one player, because you're not competing in the first place, you're competing against the game essentially. But then are there others that they might introduce some kind of solo variant. Like the only game, so most of the games I've been playing aren't retro, by our definition, but there was one called Race for the Galaxy that I actually bought when it wouldn't have qualified as retro. I bought it when it was fairly new, and then I never played it. Because it's not on its own a solo game. I just bought it with the hopes that I would play it with somebody and never did. Because I really liked the idea of board games. I like board games, and I hadn't played a lot of the more specialized ones, but I had wanted to. And then only recently did I find out that they came out with an expansion to the game that included solo rules. So in that case, you actually have like a special card and a special die, and that you roll to basically. It basically tells you what the, you could call it an AI really, is going to do on their turn. And it's designed to be pretty tough and pretty challenging. But you really could look at it as like playing solitaire, with a deck of cards, but just in a like really super advanced manner. It's a lot more complex than that, you know?
Yeah, I never really thought of board games being that, but I don't see why not, because that's what you're doing when you're playing on the computer. You're just having some kind of emulation of somebody else.
And so it's basically you just have, instead of a computer, you have rules, that someone came up with that you follow, and to simulate that side of it. And it's been nice because I'm not putting as much wear on my arms but it's also giving me a similar feeling to playing a video game. It's been pretty neat. I kind of also wasn't aware that it was a thing and sort of stumbled across it. And actually, on one of the video game podcasts I listen to, they will occasionally talk about board games, and they talked about one, and then it just became like, as you say, a rabbit hole that I went down, discovered that it's, especially in recent years, I mean, I don't even know if 10 years ago it was really that common, but in recent years is like, with the internet, the way things have gotten, everything is so specialized, you know? Like if you're interested in this weird minute hobby, like
you'll find back, somebody else that is.
You'll
too.
Find other people, yeah. and it escalates and encourages, you know, both in good and bad ways. these kind of minute people, or people with specific. So that's been kind of interesting, and I thought, well, I'll have to tell Mike I'm doing something with physical media. Yeah.
For me, physical media is just more relaxing. I don't know why, but it is.
It is good to get away from a screen.
Yeah. I think it has to do with work. Like, it does. Working in where I work and being in front of a terminal, and it's put a distaste or an association in my brain that I don't like to do. Even though some of the things I covered today I did read off of Marvel Unlimited, because it's easier to read in the middle of the night sometimes if I don't want to move on the iPad.
Right.
Even though it's horribly bad for you, supposedly, because of the LED, the screen. They have like things that could make you can tint the screens down and black
filters,
screen and filter, and it's still, I think that it is some kind of stimuli on your eyes and brain still. But
yeah, probably it's still not perfect, and also it doesn't work so good. It's I use a filter on my tablet because I read books on it a lot at night. And that's fine, but I found that it's not as nice with comics, because it's actually changing the color. You know, it's a colored tint, so it's going to change the way the comic looks, whereas if it's just text, it doesn't matter.
Right.
But yeah, so a lot of times if I do read comics on my tablet, it's during the day or with like another light source. So yeah, why don't you take advantage of that segue?
Well, this was physical media that I did read. I'll start with. I got it in the dollar bin. I think my shop is going under, so they have way more sales than they've ever had that I've ever experienced. And they never used to have a dollar box or, 50 cent box, and now they have them. And I've been taking advantage of them, especially with Marvel, because unlike Marvel, with DC, I always would buy, like, always. So I have most of everything. But with Marvel, I would always, like, pick and choose, and I would miss a lot. And now I'm filling in those gaps. And I'm trying to complete my Alpha Flight run. And this cover caught my attention. I didn't know it was part 2 of 4, but I didn't have the other two parts. But it didn't matter, because it had the Wrecking Crew. I've always, like the idea of the Wrecking Crew. They're all, the Wrecker, Thunderball, and all these guys that look like they work in the junkyard. they had got an Asgardian powered crowbar, and the Wrecker distributed his power amongst the others so they would have power. And this one takes place in the middle of a story arc where it sounds like Canada is getting very anti-hero. They are sort of wanting to pass their registration acts, just like in Civil War and stuff. And this 119 took place in 1993, so that was prior to Civil War. So they were already having like these registration acts, and I think X-Men probably has had that concept way earlier than Alpha Flight, even. the mutant registration. But
Yeah.
at this time, Alpha Flight doesn't even look, I mean, they vaguely look familiar to me, but there's like a guy called Windshear. I don't even know who he is. There's the Guardian, who's the, you know, female, Northstar and Aurora, Puck, Sasquatch, so you get the ones that you normally see. And then there's some other characters, like, I didn't know the Purple Man had a daughter, or some kind of, I don't even know the relationship, but she appears briefly in here. And then there's Weapon, there's somebody who looks like I don't even think they've mentioned her name, but she looks like she's a magic being, and she looks sort of like a cross between Spawn and Spider-Man. And she has like magic powers, and I don't remember them mentioning her name, but she seems pretty powerful. But anyway, this is written by Simon Furman, and if I remember correctly, I think that's a Transformer writer. Like, I think Simon Furman wrote a lot of Marvel Transformers, and he even wrote Transformers for IDW. And then Pat Broderick, who I know very well. When I actually looked at some of this art, there's a couple of splash pages. I thought it was JR. Especially when they're like splash pages of the Wrecking Crew. But it is Pat Broderick, and I've always liked Pat Broderick's art. I've known him from Captain Atom mostly. He's drawn a lot of stuff, though. I even bought some Kickstarter that he did fairly recently. I actually met him at the con here, which was, it's a very small con. The first time I've actually met Pat Broderick. But they're fighting the Wrecking Crew, and the Wrecking Crew in this seem like really powerful, because Alpha Flight seems like they have like, I don't know, 15 members. And then Omega, Weapon Omega shows up, and Wildheart and Goblin and Pathway. I guess Pathway is somebody that can open up breaches. They show up. And if it wasn't for some smart intuition by Puck noticing that the Wrecking Crew between Thunderball and the Wrecker are fighting for, like, who's going to run the crew, it seems like the Wrecker has been, like, in a dimension away from, and Thunderball took the team, and actually seems to be like a smarter head on his shoulder than the Wrecker ever was. But since then, the Wrecker is trying to establish his dominance, and there's some Canadian organization that actually paid them to destroy things, and I think it's because they're trying to make Alpha Flight look bad and start this Hero Registration Act. So that's the gist of the story. And then there's some other weird stuff in here by a character that I've never heard of, but he seems almost like a god. Let's see if they mention his name. Whitman Knapp. I've never heard that name before, but he seems to have some kind of like godlike power, and he's a side story. But it was good seeing Alpha Flight again, especially Puck. There's some dynamic scenes, because I always like watching Puck flip and stuff, because he's such a short guy. And the brother and sister twins working together was pretty cool. It does look weird, though, because at this point in time, Alpha Flight was trying to look like they were wearing uniforms. In other words, they didn't Aurora and Northstar did not have those white and black outfits. They had Canadian outfits that had the maple leaf on the side, and they were red and white, and everybody was wearing the red and white, including Puck. The only one that didn't have a standard outfit was Sasquatch. But it was a pretty cool issue. I kind of dug it, and I like on the cover how the Wrecking Crew is on the front cover, and it says the Wrecking Crew is back. They're gonna F you up. But it's a part two of a story, and it kind of wants me. I want to go read more for the Wrecking Crew than Alpha Flight. What the other two parts are, because I've always. The Wrecking Crew was one of those early Defenders issues that I had with Luke Cage, and I just adored it as a kid, and I read it like 17, 18 times, and it would carry me with it everywhere. And it's good to see them again. I wish that I had action figures of the Wrecking Crew. I know they came out at one point, and I never got them, but I don't know if they have them all. I know they had the Wrecker for sure.
Yeah, I know I've seen a few of them here and there in some of the lines, the Legends lines that they've done.
They are an amazing line of toys. I've been buying some as we go along. And I just picked up Doctor Doom. I don't care for how the FF look, because they're not like the classic look. But I did pick up a She-Hulk, a Thing, because Thing always looks like Thing anyway. I wish the Torch was on fire, I would have gotten him, but he's just like Johnny with hands that you can attach that are on fire. But it makes the Super Skrull, and I've always liked the Super Skrull. So there's a temptation to finish it and open them all up and make the figure. Like, I've been looking for Galactus, and he's so expensive because he was those Build-A-Figures. Some people are asking for $300. And right now, like, Galactus and the Surfer, like, they're big on my radar because I've been reading so much lately with that adopt-a-character.
Yeah, that's kind of tough if you're just looking to buy the Build-A-Figure by itself.
Yeah. I was even thinking of getting the cheesy one that Toy Biz made, but they're not cheap either.
Because that's older, right?
Yeah, and that one talks or something. It's got a button you push it and talks to some effect.
That's pretty
But
funny.
speaking of video games, when I was sort of into it, even though I was never into gaming after ColecoVision, I think my interest diminished with the exception of sports games. But my brother had a Nintendo before there was the Nintendo 64, there was just that Nintendo. And I had a Silver Surfer game I bought for it, and it was pretty awesome. So, like, if I ever had the opportunity to buy one of those with the Silver Surfer game, I probably would buy it just for retro reasons.
I forgot that there was a Silver Surfer game.
Yeah, and it had Heralds of Galactus, and I've always loved the Heralds of Galactus. I find the Galactus is fascinating from a religious and purposeful perspective. Like, he's not a villain. Like, he's not. He's just like you or I that's going to eat something. Where you eat plants, he's going to eat the world, and I eat meat. He just needs to devour planets. That's his sustenance. That's what he does to live.
Yeah, I haven't listened to all of it, but I listened to some of the last episode that you guys did with Kyle, and
Yeah.
yeah, it was interesting hearing about Silver Surfer. For some reason, it didn't seem to fit the pattern of the other comics that I was into when I was a kid, but for whatever reason, that Ron Lim, Jim Starlin run on Silver Surfer really fascinated me, and
Yeah.
it's just so Marvel Cosmic is just so strange with some of the bizarre, godlike beings that are out there in that universe, and the way it basically kind of I don't think I knew it at the time, but it nicely led into the the first Infinity Gauntlet, which I really dug.
Yeah.
But yeah, that I really like the way that I really like Ron Lim's style. He was a good artist for Silver Surfer, I think.
Yeah, but, I'm reading the Engelhart and Marshall Rogers sort of right now, and I've always liked Marshall Rogers, so he was there like towards the beginning of that run that you're talking about.
Yeah, that's. I don't think I've ever read that stuff.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. I stopped only that so series to start the Adlard and the Dan Slott run because, at least digitally, and collected edition, because I have the Epic collections. It kind of that run has a huge gap between 14 and like 60, you know. So, and I kind of want to read them sequentially because all the different plot threads. Like, I don't want to miss it just to jump ahead. I want to wait till I can consume the whole thing. So I kind of jumped to the other volumes in the meantime.
Nice.
So what do you got?
Yeah, so I actually read some Marvel stuff too, as it turned out. Both of the all the stuff I read was actually from the Marvel Knights imprint, which was interesting for me personally, just because I read a bunch of it. Sort of brought me back to when I got back into comics around 20 years ago or so, because Marvel Knights was going at that time. But all the stuff I read wasn't stuff that I had read before. The first thing I was going to talk about was Black Panther, the Christopher Priest Black Panther, which a couple years ago they put out complete collections of.
Mm-hmm.
I had read this towards the end of the run. I had heard it was good and had picked up a handful of issues before it switched to like the New York City Black Panther.
Yeah.
Right at the end of the run.
Yeah, and that's when somebody else took over at that run. Was Priest still on that when he went to New York?
I think it was still.
Oh, I'm thinking of Daredevil. Never mind, because at one time Black Panther became Daredevil.
Yeah, it was. That was another like.
Yeah.
Way they switched it up. I think he did the whole run.
Because I read that when it's weird for me, but Marvel Knights was so good at the time that that was a series that, you know how I'm a mood reader, that I would always read as it came out. I'd read Black Panther and I'd read Daredevil. Those were my two Marvel Knights books that I just had to consume. And the Inhumans, mm-hmm. but that was only 12 issues.
Yeah, I think I read some of that. Yeah, I'd picked up a bunch of Marvel Knights stuff. Like I said, I didn't get into the series until later on. I think it was Marvel Knights had already been around for a couple of years before I started checking out comics again.
Yeah.
But
that was Jimmy Palmiotti and Quesada.
That really
edited that entire line.
Yeah, that was kind of their baby.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this this first issue actually is it's interesting because the credits are interesting because
which issue was this? Is the very first one?
Number one, yeah. Okay. I read number one, number two. I just kind of flowed right into two because of the way that number one ends. But
yeah.
Obviously, Christopher Priest is the writer, and Mark Teixeira is credited for art. But then Joe Quesada is credited as storytelling and on both issues. And then Aletha Martinez is considered is credited for background assists.
Interesting.
Yeah, so I don't
because sometimes storytelling, at least when I hear that, it means layouts. Like
right, that's how
lay the plan out, then the artist comes and draws it, and it sounds like he even had extra help, like once he drew it, to go fill in the background. She came in and did that assist, you know.
Yeah.
And it probably was because Texieria, or however you want to pronounce it, was pretty big at the time.
Yeah.
Especially for dark mooded, you know, books, you know.
Right. Yeah, that's pretty much how I pieced that all together was Quesada did layouts and then Tashir came in and put, you know, did the main figures and then Martinez filled in the backgrounds. It kind of the colors, I don't know if it's because of the colors, but it almost has like a painterly look to it.
Yeah.
In style, which at times I like. Most of the time I like. There's moments that it looks a little funny, but the story is told by a guy named Everett K. Ross, and he's like a government agent. And, you know, Priest has this habit of using nonlinear storytelling.
And he still does.
Yeah, even as recent, you know, as his DC work. But it's interesting because in this, at least in these two issues, it's part of like it's part of the narrative directly in a way because Ross is relating the story to his boss, who also seems to be his lover. So he keeps starting the story and she keeps stopping him and getting increasingly frustrated with him and trying to get him to tell the story in a linear way and to start from the beginning instead of continuing to like jump ahead. So it's kind of interesting that it's actually a part of the story that the character is telling out of order and there's another character telling him to go in order and to back up. So it still gives you like flashes ahead as to like strange things that are going to come. But she kind of eventually gets him on track. What it comes down to is that Black Panther has come to New York because there was this fundraiser called the Tomorrow Fund, and that there was some kind of there was a scandal with how the money was being handled, and that money was being laundered into gang activity, and then the details as to how this happened aren't quite clear, but a young child was killed in something that happened. So he comes over, and this Ross is supposed to be his government contact. And he's kind of an idiot. He shows up in like a two-seat convertible to pick up Black Panther, and Black Panther's there with his whole entourage. There's a ton of people, so he doesn't really have room in the car. And then he plans on taking him to a hotel, but Black Panther insists on staying in the projects near where this incident took place and where this Tomorrow Fund is operating. So as that goes on, we get some more and more backstories to what caused all this to take place. But Black Panther starts working contacts in the city and trying to investigate on his own at night. But throughout the first issue, Ross, in his recollection, is missing his pants. And it's he keeps trying to explain how he's missing his pants, but his boss keeps pushing him back to explain how he got to the circumstances in the first place. The first issue ends with him. He's kind of hanging out in this apartment in the projects, while he's waiting for Black Panther to come back from going out on the rounds. And there's a knock on the door, and he answers the door, and it's the devil. I don't know if it's Mephisto specifically, but there's a nice second to last page at the end of the first issue where he answers the door, and there's this huge devil, and there's flames around the door. And then on the final page, you just Ross slams the door shut and tells T'Challa's uncle, who's there with him, that it's for him. But the second issue picks up from there, and there's a little bit of comedy where the devil has made his own throne of bones to sit on in the apartment next to the couch where Ross is sitting. And trying to make small talk with the devil, and then the issue of his pants come up, and the devil gives him pants. And at first he's excited, and then he kind of realizes that he accepted pants from the devil, and that might have been a bad idea.
Yeah, I might lose my soul for a pair of pants.
Exactly.
If I remember correctly, that was Mephisto.
Yeah, I'm
If
pretty sure it is,
I
but
think they reveal it somewhere down the line.
yeah, I'm not sure if it's specifically stated in these two issues, but so there's a lot of hijinks, like
But he's the comic relief of the book, and he's always there to make like political intrigue have some humor to it.
Right, yeah, because he's totally an idiot. Like he's trying to like he's like there's an incident where they run into like some Hispanic gangs, and Ross is says, "Y'all be cool, just chill, don't start none, won't be none." So he's trying to act like badass, you know,
Yeah, you be
and
cool and everything be everything.
the guy, the leader of the gang, just grabs his ID and takes a big bite out of it, and then later Ross realizes that the gang leader took his actually just took his ID with him, he goes to try to track it down at the bar where the gang heads, and there's women's mud wrestling going on, and the guy throws the his ID into the mud pit, and then throws Ross in after it. So Ross and then Black Panther and his entourage show up, and Black Panther's uncle Zuri, he knows that Ross is under T'Challa's protection, so he runs in, and it turns into like this big fight in the mud pit between all these women and Zuri and Everett Ross. And as a result, like Ross and Zuri, Black Panther, and the Dora Milaje all get booked at a precinct in Brooklyn. But I definitely enjoyed it. I know it has a really strong reputation. I would say like the only thing that kind of like doesn't really, reading it today post Black Panther movie and stuff, which, you know, this run was definitely very influential to the movie. Speaking of the Dora Milaje, it's interesting how they're depicted and talked about. Like, it's implied that they're teenagers, and not real clear on which side of the legal they are. But they're dressed, at least once they get to New York City, they're dressed in mini skirts, and they're drawn very voluptuously and very like skin tight clothes, and they're still badasses. But if you contrast that with like, these are the two characters that were played by it's Okoye and Nakia. So it's the two characters that were played by Lupita Nyong'o and Danai Gurira in the movie. So you can definitely see a strong contrast in how they chose to depict these two characters in the movie versus this. And I think the movie depiction is a lot more appropriate and a lot better choice. But other than that, I mean, most of the time I really like the art style. There are some moments where Black Panther in his costume, whether it's T'Shira or whoever at this point, almost goes a little overboard on the muscles, just in how specifically detailed they are. But the writing is really great. You know, there's a scene where Ross is initially talking about the assignment when he first gets the assignment, and he really shows like his ignorance. But it's also like this run was kind of responsible for bringing Black Panther back into spotlight when Marvel had really hadn't done much with him in a long time, and he hadn't had, so his reputation wasn't really that high. And so you kind of, almost like when Jeff Johns did the Aquaman New 52, puts like a sort of acknowledgement of the character's current status in comics outside of, in, you know, in the real world. When Ross says that he's as dangerous as Batroc and doesn't have any powers or anything, you know. But he also straight up gets racist, calling him Eldridge Cleaver, and says that he just hangs out at the Avengers mansion ordering up ribs. So he's definitely, he's like the comic relief, but also represents like
white man,
white racist, perspective. I mean, he does call himself like.
Does change over the course of the book, though.
Yeah, I mean, even in these first couple issues, like that represents where he's at when he first gets the assignment, and he's already seems changed by the events that he's describing. And he says, on the very first page of the first issue, he's narrating and he calls himself Emperor of Useless White Boys. So, but yeah, it was good stuff to check out and see the beginning. Like I said, I had read some issues towards the end of the run, but it was cool to see the beginning of it.
Yeah, that's a good run. I always wonder with the Epic collections that the two areas they seem to like keep avoiding is that Black Panther run, because they have the, you know, the Christopher Priest volumes. And the Walt Simonson Thor. And I don't know why they're doing that, but maybe they're trying to wait until those volumes dissipate and then bring them back as an epic.
Probably, because I mean, these only came out, I think, in like 2018. Yeah. So the epic line was already around, but I guess they just wanted to emphasize that it was the Christopher Priest.
Yeah. I held off on those, and I should have got them, because I don't know if they'll ever get around to the epic. Because I have all the other volumes. I have all of, like, Black Panther and Daredevil, I have all of the volumes and singles, but I want the trades too, because those are my two favorite, those are my characters.
Mm-hmm.
So, the only run that I'm missing in trade is that run, because I was like, you know what, there'll be an epic, but I'm starting to doubt it. I don't know. I'm sure it'll happen eventually, because... maybe with another Black Panther movie, we'll get some more epic collections, because a lot of the collections came out around the time of the movie, and some of them were like, I think the ones that you're talking about were redone. They had original trades, and then there were those ones.
Yeah.
I don't know if they did the full run in trade. I know they did the first two at least. So.
Well. At least with, you know, if it was DC, the Epic line probably already be canceled by now, so.
Yeah.
At least since it's Marvel, they're still doing it.
I think that Dan DiDio and crew are trying to live in a world where they're trying to appease AT&T, who's in the hole right now. So... they're trying to find out what they can get away with and what they can't do. Like, I think they're being micromanaged to the point where if a book doesn't have X amount of pre-orders, they just can't justify it to the bosses to do it.
Yeah.
And,
yeah, I mean,
Marvel doesn't
was...
have that issue, though. Like, Marvel, maybe they will at some point. Marvel, with the Disney... money doesn't seem to care, because I'm sure a lot of trades in the Marvel world are non-profitable, especially because they release every single and monthly, and those numbers are, oh, we sold 200 when it comes out, and then you never see it in the list again. But
yeah.
The one thing with the collected editions is you don't ever know what the bookstores and the Scholastic are selling. You just don't.
Right.
And that's where I think the majority of people would go. Why would you go to buy it at an LCS at full price? I mean, there's mail order, which you could do, but like DCBS comes in on those numbers, I would imagine, but the bookstore numbers don't.
Yeah, well, and you have people that know that comics exist and want to read some, but don't even... I mean, probably just go to Amazon or something.
Yeah.
You know, they're not even gonna know DCBS exists or bother going to finding and then going to a comic shop. You know, why would they even bother?
Well, I'm anxious for this war one because they got the war one coming out soon. And the odds I don't think are good, but I think there's more of a demand than they realize. People just don't want to pre-order DC anymore. So I'm gonna pre-order 5 copies. And what I'm gonna do with that is I'm gonna sell one after 1 year, and then another one after 2 years, and then another after 5, and then after 10. And just as an experiment, because there are a lot of people that want war comics. It's just, I don't know if they know they're available when they come out or they don't want to invest that much money, but there is a demand. It's one of those niches that I don't know if, I don't know. It'll be a fun experiment. Plus, the only thing is, if they cancel it, it'll suck up front because I paid this much and then they cancel it. But at least I'm trying to help the situation from people that are already gun shy, because they're conditioning their audience to not pre-order, because they're looking at it like you're holding up my money for X amount until you cancel it, and then you cancel it, and then yeah, I get a refund, but I could have bought something else. So, well, my next book is 2 volumes. Well, I started the second volume, but I'm just going to talk about the first issue of the second volume and the first volume. But I'm going to summarize the whole series. And I'll say that when this came out in 1987, that was roughly around Crisis, you know? And I didn't like this. I didn't like this book. At this time in my life, I did not like Keith Giffen art. Like, it was too abstract for me and too weird. And at this time, I wasn't big into Kirby, and things were different. But things have changed over time. But this is J.M. DeMatteis and Keith Giffen on Dr. Fate. And just rereading it has changed my opinion and turned something that I didn't like into a 5 out of 5. I just loved it, the second read. And over time, Keith Giffen has become one of my favorite comics artists. And like now, I'm reading Ambush Bug again, and that was another thing that was that and Legion of Superheroes. Like when he was doing the Baxter run and stuff, I found his art so dark and so, I don't know, it was different. It wasn't like a house style, it was his own style. And you either loved it at the time or you didn't like it. And I was in the one camp, but now I adore every panel. And the thing I didn't realize is I thought this volume was more of Kent Nelson book, and I didn't realize that, because I know the second volume with J.M. DeMatteis and what is his name, Sean McManus, that is the volume that I remembered and remembered loving. This volume I didn't even remember, and I thought it was Kent, and it is kind of Kent Nelson handing off the, he's old, he's very old in this book. And I think after Crisis, they were trying to, merge the what, Earth 2 with Earth 1, and all of the JSA was older, and they made Kent older, and he was really old, to the point where he was, I can't do this anymore. I'm ready to retire. I got to hand off the mantle to somebody else. And he was just exhausted with the Lords of Order and Naboo. And he go the Lords of Order wanted, the one thing I also didn't realize in his origin is that Kent was aged. Like he was in one of those archaeologist digs, and with his father, and his father found the Naboo essentially, and Naboo killed his father and sort of aged him, and he became Dr. Fate. I guess I didn't ever read the Golden Age origin story of Dr. Fate, but it makes perfect sense because Eric Strauss and Linda Strauss, this is almost like a creepy stepmom and stepchild relationship. It's amazing because Linda Strauss married this rich guy and had this son. It wasn't her born son, but because she married into it, she got Eric. And she always had this bond with Eric, like she got along with him, and she always said that he was like an older man in a young child's body, and she could never figure it out. And the husband was rich and abusive, and he not a good person. So when he passed, she decided to take care of Eric, and then he aged, and it's weird because it's like his stepmom. She's like forming a relationship. Like she wants to have a relationship with her son. And it's just weird. Like it's very bizarre, sort of uncomfortable in some situations. But he's going to get the mantle. He gets aged, Eric does. And he's going to get Kent Nelson's Dr. Fate costume. And then this character called Benjamin Stoner, along with a Lord of Chaos called Typhoon, redirect the Dr. Fate entity into to doc to this Benjamin Stoner. And Benjamin Stoner was a good man, but he had compassion over time, bleed out over time in the years, and Chaos seduced him. Typhoon basically seduced him, and he got the Dr. Fate helmet and amulet. And then it was Kent Nelson who had Naboo in him, along with the Eric and Linda, that had to actually take down Typhoon and Benjamin Stoner. And that's what this series is about. And at the end of this, Eric Strauss and Linda Strauss become the first Dr. Fate. And the other thing that's very interesting about it, at least that I didn't remember, is there's mention in here that a single entity could not control Dr. Fate. And then it was actually Kent Nelson's wife, Inza, that actually helped him for, keep any kind of control over Naboo and the Lords of Order. If it wasn't for her and the love between them, he would have been crushed. But it's almost like two bodies need to contain this, and it makes perfect sense because if you think about the other Lords of Order and Lords of Chaos, Hawk and Dove, there has to be that duality. And I love the fact that they're doing that with Dr. Fate. And then in the first issue, it just sort of takes off with Kent Nelson has sort of died, but Naboo has taken over the body of this dead corpse of and is walking around and trying to teach Linda and Eric how to don the mantle of Dr. Fate. And that's how issue one of the McManus and DeMatteis series opens up, is there's a really rich guy that always summons demons, and they had a job to, as their first task, to take down this rich guy who's always summoning demons and destroy the demons. And they left one demon alive, but he is a good demon. He never wanted to do anything bad, and he poses as their bulldog after they form the team. So it's kind of like a humorous thing because they have this demon turn into a dog and become part of the team. So yeah, I enjoyed this Dr. Fate series tremendously, and I'm glad that I reread it. I don't know what caught my attention to it. I think it's because I've been ambush bugging it with Keith Giffen, and decided I wanted to see more GIF and art, and I think that's what led me down this rabbit hole.
Yeah, that's the mini series, right?
Yeah, the 4-issue miniseries in 1987, which led to the ongoing in 1988.
Yeah, I think I read that miniseries of within the last few years. I was reading a lot of post-crisis stuff.
Yeah, it was really good.
Yeah.
It's
Cool.
weird though, because Linda loves her son in a way that is strange.
That there's a lot of that on the internet too.
Yeah,
That
there
kind of
is.
strange.
Yeah, a lot of pornography about that.
Speaking of pornography, no.
Retro. What do you got for us?
So the other Marvel Knights thing I read was I was not even aware existed is Daredevil versus Punisher Means and Ends is the subtitle. It's actually a David Laffam miniseries. I didn't realize he had done this. I mean, I've read some David Laffam stuff because of you and Bill talking about him, and obviously he's real well known for Stray Bullets. But I remember I read a bunch like Dan the Unharmable because you guys had talked about it. So this obviously, even though it's Marvel Knights, is obviously not as crazy as some of the other stuff that he has done, but he both wrote and drew this miniseries, which is cool because I like him both as an artist and a writer. And I also read the first two issues of this. I think it's six issues. And the first issue is mostly from Punisher's point of view. It starts out with the Punisher narrating the first page is four horizontal panels. The first panel is kind of a far out view of New York, and then it zooms in on the next to a park, maybe Central Park, I'm not sure. There's a couple laying on the grass. Everyone kind of looks happy, and then the third panel, it's zoomed in on their faces as they're kissing, but in the background, if you're paying attention, you can see a dead bird, and then the fourth panel is just zoomed in on the dead bird, and the Punisher's narration goes along with this kind of just about the city being full of, as he says, a bottomless soup of human rot and excrement. And how he doubts that there are even any decent people left. And then, so then it goes from there, it goes into the, gives you a bit of background of what's going on, continuing the Punisher's narration of that there's a, it's one of those situations where there's a, where the Kingpin is out of the picture, so there's a power vacuum that a lot of people are competing for, and Hammerhead is the one that's kind of starting to come out on top. The first scene, as you might call it, is the Punisher waiting in a abandoned building across the street from where Hammerhead and he's a man that is in his entourage that looks, he's bald and kind of has weird ears and looks real old. And his skin is green as accompanying the Hammerhead. But basically, and Punisher thinks that he recognizes this guy, but then he forces himself to focus. He's got a long range sniper. He's intending to shoot Hammerhead in the neck. But just as he takes the shot, or as he's about to take the shot, as he's taking the shot, Daredevil's billy club flies in and ricochets off a bunch of stuff in the corner that he's set up in, throwing him off so that the shot goes high. And so there's the two of them go back and forth, Punisher continuing to narrate and talking about how Daredevil knows that Punisher's not going to take a shot at him. So they go at it with fists, and that, I like the Punisher's narration, because he talks about how he's commenting on both Daredevil's boxing ability, like how he sees boxing in Daredevil's fighting style, but also Eastern influence of Eastern martial arts and stuff. And Daredevil gets a lot of hits in, and Punisher's more relying on his physical toughness to take it. But it breaks up by the fact that police and FBI and stuff, SWAT, are coming in. Punisher throws down a smoke grenade and escapes. And then I found it kind of interesting in this first issue. While it switches to Daredevil's perspective, the narration is in the third person, so it doesn't get directly inside of Daredevil's head, whereas the Punisher's narration was first person. So I thought that was kind of an interesting choice, because it keeps Daredevil ever so slightly at a distance from. And it's the Punisher whose head we're more inside of. And we only spend a little bit of time with Daredevil before it goes back to Punisher, and where he's outside. Well, he's some distance from and looking through binoculars at this place called the Melville Building, which is where he knows that Hammerhead is holed up on the top floors of. And he realizes that guy with the green skin, he recognizes the Jackal, who he has a history with when he was younger. So his next plan is to use a vast amount of explosives to blow up the top of the building that they're in. But before he even gets a chance to get to the warehouse where he's got the explosives stored, he sees Daredevil waiting for him from a distance. He knows that his plan is screwed, that he's not going to be able to pull it off, and that it's going to take him most of the night just to lose Daredevil's trail. He's got enough experience with Daredevil that he knows what he's capable and stuff of. It's interesting, because in these two issues, at one point, both the Punisher and Daredevil either think or make a comment about the fact that the other might as well be on Hammerhead's payroll, because from their perspective, the other one is making their job and what they're trying to accomplish so much more difficult. Daredevil sees Punisher as causing all this extra chaos, like the violence with which he goes after Hammerhead's men is causing an equal reaction of violence from Hammerhead's group, and causing lots of chaos in Hell's Kitchen, whereas the Punisher is frustrated and angry with Daredevil because he's getting in the way of him accomplishing what he's trying to do, even though he's making some strikes against some lower ranking men. He's not getting the target that he actually wants. But it's also, I also like the way that Punisher ducks into a diner at one point, and what the family that owns this diner you think might just be there for this one scene, but at least through the second issue continue to be a part of the story, because you have you know, the owner, when he comes in and hands the menu to the Punisher, the owner's got a black eye and a broken arm, and then his son, who's busting tables, has a black eye also, and it's pretty clear that you know, they've been roughed up for protection money, and while the Punisher's in there being served, the owner's daughter comes out and reminds him of his dead wife, down to the way that she smells. And but some men come in, clearly looking for the Punisher, and the waitress Mary, she sees that he's holding a gun behind his menu, but the men leave, and he stands up, he's gonna leave, but he goes out back, and basically the man's son is the one that he's real frustrated with, the way that his father is handing over all this money. It's from the boy that the Punisher gets the name of the guy who's been shaking them down. So the boy goes in and says, "Hey, tell Pop that I got that stomach thing again," and then takes off, and he basically goes to where he knows he essentially just sent the Punisher, and hangs out on the street, like peeking in through the window, and he witnesses as the Punisher guns down and kills all the men in the bar. He goes outside, the kid's just thrown up because of what he's witnessed, but then he jumps up and hugs the Punisher and talks about how awesome it was and how he's the greatest, so the first issue ends with the boy running away with a smile on his face, and Punisher thinking about how maybe there is some decent people in the city, just thinking this family that he's encountered. But then he hears like two people shouting in one of the apartment buildings above him. That makes it pretty clear that there's some domestic violence going on, and he, you know, that kind of undermines his recent thoughts. The second issue we do get, there's a bit more Daredevil. It's interesting because the first time we're with Daredevil, it's the narration is in first person, and then later on it kind of switches back to the method that he used in the first issue, where it's third person. Whereas throughout the issue, anytime we're with the Punisher, it stays first person. But things escalate with the gang activity. Punisher kind of walks into a trap in a subway, gets shot in the leg, but takes out a ton of other guys himself. And one of which is like a pair of guys that are like underbosses, and he gets one of them and the other one gets away. But I found it interesting that, and like I mentioned, I was surprised to see that the family from the diner continued to show up, and which I thought was a nice touch. The son has bought a gun, and he shows his sister, the waitress, she promises not to tell their parents that he's got the gun, only because he says he's going to get rid of it, which obviously he doesn't. But later on, because he has it, you know, he's out with friends, and he it gives him the nerves to go up and talk to a popular girl that he's got a crush on, but she starts kind of laughing at him, and her boyfriend comes up and pushes the son over when he's walking, and his gun falls out of his pants, but he sort of falls on top of it and covers it up. But it's enough that at this point it's clear that that's a threat that's going to continue in the miniseries, which I found interesting. Pretty much other than that, in the second issue, Daredevil and the Punisher are both still wanting to target Hammerhead. Daredevil breaks his way through all of the security that Hammerhead has in the building he's in. Daredevil basically wants him to, he's not going to make a deal with him. Basically telling him like, stop what you're doing now, or, you know, if it doesn't, he'll be back after he's done dealing with the Punisher. It's not a matter of whether he's going to go to prison or not, but how many pieces he's going to be in when he gets there. But the Jackal comes out after Daredevil leaves, and they're having a conversation, and Daredevil is standing, or excuse me, the Jackal is standing against the one wall that's all windows, and he's looking out at the city. And they're talking about how if the Punisher knew he was up there, he'd stop at nothing to get at him. And just as he's saying that, a couple bullets hit and crack the glass where he's standing, and he ducks down, and we see the Punisher was basically testing out his weapon to see if he'd need something bigger or not, and only because he didn't have something, a stronger weapon than that, was the only thing that saved the Jackal. So it ends with the Punisher and Daredevil encountering each other again. They both track down one of the one underboss that got away earlier from the Punisher. Punisher gets there first, and he's ready to kill him, basically. I mean, the guy says, "I'll talk," and Punisher's like, I don't care. I'm not interested in you talking. And that's where Daredevil shows up, and they start fighting. Daredevil starts trying to take Punisher down. It's kind of funny, the underboss guy, he's like, tries to get a shot at one of them, because he thinks that they're not paying attention to him, and that this will be a chance for him to get square with Hammerhead again. And as soon as he lifts up his gun, Daredevil's billy clubs, smacks him in the face and knocks him out. But it ends with the door to the room opening, and the last panel is just filled with flames, like somebody showed up with a flamethrower. The story continues. But yeah, I was...
How are you reading that, in digital or...?
Digital through Hoopla, the trade. But yeah, I wasn't aware of it, and it was kind of it was Laugham's name that brought me into it. I mean, I like both characters, but I tend to, like, when the miniseries is titled like so and so versus so and so, and I tend to shy away from those. They're not, a lot of times they're not really like, I haven't found them to be that hot, but the David Laugham name got me to try it.
He does everything too, so.
Yeah, and I like his art, I like his writing, and I trusted he would do something interesting with it. And I like that, You know, sometimes the Punisher, he, depending on how he's written, he can, you can kind of lose any sympathy for him. And he kind of slips from being an anti-hero to more of a villain. And I think he calls back to the tragedy that causes the Punisher, that motivates the Punisher enough that it kind of, even if you're new to the character, you get enough sense that like you can have some sympathy for him, which I think is sort of essential to make the character interesting. You know, you hopefully don't agree with his methods, but I think you need to like feel a little sympathy for the loss that he's experienced, that the pain that he's in, that's motivating him. I think it was an interesting choice to sort of spend more time in his head than in Daredevil's, because I think it's a little easier to for the average reader to get inside Daredevil's head, you know. And what he, I mean, none of us are Daredevil, but his motivations and what he's trying to accomplish is a little bit more like where some of us might be coming from.
Yeah, he's a character that reminds me of like Man Thing or Swamp Thing, where a lot of the story techniques are around things that are going on, and he's just in the story. Like, he's the killing machine. So, yeah, you have his background, which is tragic, but most of the stories are how he slaughters a bunch of people, and the stories around either written through the eyes of the villain or written around the people that are around him. And he's interesting that way.
Yeah, and that's kind of like that's one approach, and it does work, and I've seen that approach a lot. So it's interesting that in this story, it actually is the Punisher that you spend a lot of time in, and it's more like Daredevil is more kind of the one that's treated as like I said, except for that one, like a couple pages there where you're inside his head. He's sort of the one that's more like on the outside. I think that's why it's kind of important that he makes a point of, especially when the waitress reminds him of his wife. You see some panels of her lying dead after being shot and stuff, and you get like a couple panels of like them as a happy family and stuff, and the touch with the. But you still have like your supporting characters, and I think, as I mentioned, I like how he brings them into the second issue and keeps it as this kind of subplot.
Yeah, he's good. He's good at like making a comic. I don't know how to say it, but like have all these threads in it, and these threads go out throughout the whole story and just making things interesting. So I think that's all I had. I don't know if you have another book to cover, but I read a lot of Dr. Fate. The other thing that I've been into lately is trying to watch movies from around the time Star Wars came out, because it meant a lot to me. And I want to watch The Deep because I read the adaptation in Marvel Comics, and I absolutely loved it. And I love like underwater movies, so I want to watch The Deep. I want to watch Orca. I think there's a movie called Barracuda. So yeah, I
Barracuda.
want to get into those.
That's interesting.
Yeah, that Barracuda I think was in the soundtrack for Birds of Prey.
Oh yeah, did you go see that yesterday?
Yeah, we saw it actually on Friday. Me and Barb took a snow day off, and even though we wanted to stay off the roads, we went out anyway to go see a movie. But the movie theater is like right by our house.
Yeah, so you're not going far.
I think it's like 3 miles away.
Yeah, that's not bad.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, that's pretty much for me. It for me. As I mentioned, I mean, I've been continuing to watch some '90s TV, sci-fi TV. I started. I know I've talked about Star Trek. I'm still. I think I have like. I have only a handful of episodes left of Next Generation. Because I started alternating with Deep Space Nine, because that's how they originally aired. And then once Next Generation went off the air, Voyager replaced it. And so then Voyager and Deep Space Nine were both on, like, together for a while. So I've been continuing to watch them. The last season of Next Generation is has been really uneven. It's definitely like past its prime. There's still some really good episodes, and I mean, I've gotten to know these characters really well at this point, so I enjoy even the episodes that aren't that great. But yeah, it's not at its best. But whereas Deep Space Nine keeps ramping up. I'm on the second season of that. I don't think it's as at its best yet, but I'm definitely enjoying it and getting to know the characters better.
Yeah, I still gotta finish. Me and you started Battlestar Galactica. I gotta get to that at some point and
Oh,
finish
yeah.
it. I was glad we took on Taxi Driver though, because I think it put me in the mind space to love Joker so much. I don't know. It just.
Yeah, it sounds like it was a pretty huge influence on it, so
Yeah, it. I mean.
you could kind of see that.
It's my favorite movie ever. And I think it's because I could talk about it, all the different layers of it, forever.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely want to check that out.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's not a superhero movie, but
No.
it plays around with that Elseworlds of it, like it being in that world.
Yeah. Honestly, that makes me more interested because I'm sort of, I don't know, like, if sick of might be too strong of a word, but I'm definitely like not that. I'm past the point where I'm really interested in seeing all the superhero movies that come out. Like,
Yeah.
I pick and choose only ones that might stand out from the rest. Like, I'm definitely looking forward to the next Wonder Woman movie. But there's so many of them.
Yeah, there you get something almost every other month, for sure.
Yeah.
And even if you have like a movie channel, you'd be shocked to see something during the day that's not a superhero
Oh, yeah, or a show, or yeah, there's a lot. But I also started, so I also been mixing in X-Files, which I really didn't watch back in the day either.
I didn't either. I watched the tail end when Barb was watching it, but it was. I watched the movie and I watched, I don't know, an episode here and there because I would always read comics while Barb was watching X-Files, but I never really like watched it. But I did like what I did watch.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's an interesting time period of television because, like, it's very transitional. Like, Deep Space Nine is like they haven't really gotten too deep into it yet, but as the show goes on, I know it gets more and more serialized and a lot less more like single one and done episodes like Next Generation was, and it was
Yeah.
kind of the first Star Trek episode to do or show to do that. And like X-Files has a lot of one and done episodes, but it has like its
Its
occasional like
themes.
mythology stuff
The
that
smoking
continues.
man. The Buffalo Bills will never win the Super Bowl as long as he's alive. He must be still alive.
I guess so. So yeah, but exactly, like stuff like that, and so it's interesting because that's kind of where a lot of that stuff started to get to where we are today, where it's so common for a show to, you know, just be an ongoing story.
Yeah. I've been enjoying Batwoman because of the complexity of the relationship between Kate and Alice and her father. Like, it's just so complex that I like that story a lot.
I haven't seen any of the show. I know that's
Alice does the actress that plays Alice does really good.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, she does.
I mean,
really,
I know that's
really
that's a relationship that I liked from the comics, that whole dynamic.
Yeah, and they really bang the drum on that TV show on just. You're conflicted because, you know, your sister died, you know, and then you were searching for her for all these years, and you find out that she's alive and a murderer, but you still, she's your sister, you know?
Yeah.
So what do you do? And they've added a lot more layers of complexity to that thread. And it's been pretty cool. I've liked it. So I've watched all of the CWs up to Crisis, and now I'm finally gonna watch Crisis, because I don't think Black Panther played a part in the TV show. I think I've got caught up in Flash, Supergirl, Legends of Tomorrow, and all the other series, Arrow, to watch Crisis now. I'm looking forward to that because they already explored like Crisis a lot in the Arrow this season, and it's interesting how they mesh themes of the comic book into what the TV series has been, you know. I find it fascinating.
Yeah, I've only heard a few things in passing about some of the stuff that they did with Crisis, but it sounded fun.
Yeah, and they recently came out with the Crisis 100-page Giants, and they tie into the new material ties into the TV show, which is even more interesting. So I love those Giants, man. God, I love them so much. They are so retro. I mean, speaking of, they just have the same feel that those 100-page Giants did back in the day.
Yeah.
You'd sometimes have new story, and then you'd have reprints. I just find fascinating how they choose the reprints and what's in it, and rereading them, and the $4.99 price point for that is just amazing. I mean, compared to what comics cost now. They're expensive.
Yeah, they must. A lot, usually stuff that size, I think, would be more like $10. So they must be doing something to like keep the price low.
Right. Well, it's great talking to you again, Chris. And hopefully the next
here.
Time we record, it'll be all three of us. But at least we can keep the wheels moving.
Yeah, we'll get there at some point.
Eventually, yeah.
Yeah. All right, sounds good.
We're thinking of going to Niagara sometime.
Oh, yeah, that'd be awesome.
And we would like to stop and see you guys if possible.
Yeah, of course.
Rob. But we haven't like ironed out any dates yet.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely.
Do you know what time is a good time that is sort of warm? You know, like not overly warm, but not snow, no snow, and that time period that the traffic is not as bad, like for that type of tourism event.
Yeah, anytime. I mean, April can kind of go either way, but I would say by May it's at least mild.
Okay.
And then as you get like, or like once kids go back to school, September is usually still nice.
Okay.
And October is usually like, so-so.
Right.
But it's usually like late November through March is when it, I mean, this winter actually has been really mild, but
We got hammered this last week. I mean, it just didn't stop snowing. We had at least a foot out back. It was a wet
yeah, your
snow,
weather's
though,
crazy.
so it's like, it was really bad, like inside roads, but the other roads, it was sort of wet enough that it was turning to water. Yeah. All right, well, we'll talk to you soon, and you have a good Sunday.
All right, sounds good. You too.
Take care. Bye.
Okay, bye.